boys and girls, that was the Greek national anthem, or at least a shorter version of it, I guess. We do that in honor of the Greeks, who seem to have had the internal fortitude to tell the IMF to go fuck themselves, and they did it very soundly, following Iceland doing the same thing first. So anyhow, we salute Iceland and Greece. And who's next? Screw you, International Monetary Fund. In fact, I'm celebrating this Greek victory and the Icelandic victory more than I am the 4th of July. Yeah, because the 4th of July doesn't mean anything anymore now that we've become empire and the empirists have taken over and we're nothing but the corporate state, which Mussolini would have been jealous as hell of, because this corporate state is far, far more powerful than anything he envisioned. At least in Mussolini's corporate state, the state had something to say about what was going on, or at least had the guts to do it. And the corporations didn't run everything. But in this case, the corporations run everything and tell everyone what to do and where to do it. A typical thing about that is in France here, where Assange appealed to the French after the French had been spied upon, all their leaders spied upon by the NSA, and he asked for asylum and they wouldn't give it to him. Just shows you the international control of these goddamn corporations. Under the flags, they hide behind the flags like the stars and stripes. Anyhow, we had an interesting time. I was glad for the weekend to be over. I don't particularly enjoy holidays because they remind me of what it's turned into, something that we used to really enjoy being involved in, but not anymore. And tremendous amount of heavy fireworks was being fired off. I know that Stray Dog talked about his problem back there in New Germany, and here it was just as bad with in a county where there's 99% white people. Yeah, they're all going crazy with bigger and bigger fireworks. It sounds like a war zone, and I'm what I don't understand is why there isn't more reaction to it, since we have hundreds of veterans around with PTSD that a woman told me that her son or nephew or something, when he got home and there was a big boom like that from a backfire of a car, he dropped to the floor. You can imagine what all this fireworks does to people with PTSD. And in your community, you should start complaining as much as possible. Write letters to the newspaper and say, let's knock this shit off. But I will say this, the people who really get their jollies more than anybody else is the niggers and the Mexicans with the fireworks. And even if you have a very few of them in your area, they don't, these people are, they have no celebration for the revolution of the United States. They have no allegiance to the United States. They just like to hear things go boom. But like I say, China's picking up all the profits. Here, so-called communist China is picking up the profits on our Revolution Day, which is not my Revolution Day. Bob Matthews set up my Revolution Day. Well, I told you the other day that I was going to go back to the details on the American Revolution, and I didn't get it done yesterday, so I'm going to do it today so you get a little bit of common sense idea of why these wars are not necessary. No, they're not. People just don't seem to get it. There's always a way out of these wars without surrendering. You know, personal combat is very normal in nature. Just like in the animal world, personal combat. Very little of the killing goes on by massive numbers of animals. A wolf pack, yeah, maybe a little bit. Hyenas and stuff like that. But usually then it's no more than half a dozen or a dozen modern mechanized warfare, and even ancient warfare was not really normal or desirable, because even when someone won, it was only one side won and they got the loot, but usually their leaders got all the money anyhow. So if you were going to have a war, you'd think that at least the common soldier could get his share of the booty, but that's not the way it works out. I remember when I went into the Army, I think I was making $75 a month. When I got to Europe, due to my MOS and my job, I got about $40 more added on to that for special purposes, so forth. Not the CIA. Okay, let's get on with it. The Revolutionary War. But let me tell you, this book was written by C.H. Hamlin. And here's a statement by Benjamin Franklin. There never was a good war nor a bad peace. The war myth in U.S. history. Now, this book is still available through Abe Books and probably Amazon and those. You ought to have it in your library. It was first published in 1927. In no sense is an attempt being made here to give a complete history of the causes of the war for independence of the United States. This is simply a brief analysis of the 10 outstanding causes and the nature of the conflict without defending or opposing either side in the struggle. The common opinion in the United States regarding the American Revolution is that it was a war waged against Great Britain in which the American people as a whole rose up against the mother country in order to protect themselves against unjustifiable and unbearable oppression. This is the position taken in the Declaration of Independence, and we've always looked upon the conflict through the eyes of the Declaration of Independence. Now remember, most of what was in the Declaration of Independence was copying what the French were doing at the time. You know, liberty, fraternity, equality, and that stuff. And what the Declaration, well, the main thing the Declaration of Independence was doing was encouraging the French to help us in the revolution and get us weapons and shipping and stuff like that. It was a political act, more than a great document. The 13 colonies declared themselves free and independent on July 2, 1776. And then on July 4, 1776, adopting the Declaration of Independence, proclaiming to the world their reasons for declaring themselves free. So there you see, it should, the initial date is July the 2nd. Thus, the Declaration of Independence was not a Declaration of Independence, but a publication to the world of the causes which led the colonies to point to the point of such declaration. It was an effort to put their side before the world and justify it. It was written by Thomas Jefferson, and there's some disagreement on that. Some say that Thomas Paine wrote it in the heat of the great emotion. Well, you can tell that. 27 grievances were held against Great Britain to justify the course taken by the colonies. We shall not attempt here to study the real nature of freedom, which is much more than a question of national boundaries. And is even independent of national boundaries. But we shall accept the term in its usual narrow legal sense. The outstanding causes of the Revolutionary War were the following: the expulsion of the French from Canada in 1763, the attempt on the part of Great Britain to enforce the Navigation Acts, the British Western Land Policy, the British financial legislation regarding the colonies, the Stamp Act of 1765, the Townsend Act of 1767, the Boston Tea Party of 1773, the five punitive acts of 1776, the general economic depression during the 70s, and religious conflicts. Let us examine briefly these 10 causes. After the French were defeated by Great Britain in 1763 and lost Canada, the colonies did not feel the same need for protection by the mother country as formerly. The French on the north were defeated. The Indians gave some trouble, but were not a great power to be dreaded. As a result, the colonies felt themselves to be self-supporting. Georgia was an exception because, as the youngest of the 13 colonies, it was dependent on England for subsidies and protection from the Indians, Mongols. Thus, because the people recognized their independence, Great Britain, for protection, the movement for independence made slower headway in Georgia. By far the most important cause of the American Revolution was the effort on the part of George III to enforce the navigation laws of Great Britain. It was customary then for every mother country to regard its colonies as trading posts. Well, that's what England always did. The colonies were considered necessary as a source of raw materials for the home manufacturers in Britain and also as a market for surplus manufactured goods of the home country. In other words, this was an economic situation primarily. This economic principle was a phase of mercantilism, which was, according to Tommy, is a forerunner to capitalism, which was the dominant economic doctrine of the time. In harmony with this theory, Great Britain, as early as 1651, began passing navigation acts requiring her colonies to trade only with British merchants. All the export trade of the colonies had to be sent to Great Britain, and all their imported goods had to come from Great Britain. In addition, the ships transporting these goods had to be owned by British subjects. Nice deal, huh? This law, however, was openly violated by the colonial merchants. They traded with the Dutch or with any other foreigners they could. The British officials in America were bribed and cooperated in this illegal trade. The leading people of New England at this time were merchants. Aren't they always? And it has been estimated that 9/10 of these merchants were smugglers. John Hancock, who was to become president of the First Continental Congress in 1775, was a smuggler on a great scale and at one time sued for $500,000 as a penalty for smuggling. John Adams was his lawyer. You know, if they'd have lost the Revolutionary War, all those guys would have been hung for sure under the law. There's another book you might look into on that. C. Simmons, quote, Social Forces in the United States History, unquote, pages 61, 62. It was these merchants of New England, and especially Boston, who were among the leaders of the Revolution. But evidently, most of them were smugglers also. After the close of the French and Indian War in 1763, the English merchants and English business in general had to be heavily taxed in order to pay the enormous national debt. Accordingly, pressure was brought to bear on the British government to have the navigation laws enforced, which would give English the colonial trade, thus enabling them to meet more easily the financial demands of taxation. Efforts were then made by Great Britain to enforce these navigation laws, which had been openly violated for more than a century. So what puts them in debt to where they have to tax more is war. Always war puts you in debt faster than anything. And then there's the ramifications. Their legality had never been questioned. It was the, well, because questioning the crown of England, good luck. It was the usual policy of all countries that of that age in dealing with their colonies. These navigation laws were no doubt unwise interference with trade, but their legality was not questioned, as all modern tariffs are trade barriers, which does not make their violation legal. Well, we need some tariffs in this country. We almost forgot about any tariffs at all. That's why we're flooded with Chinese crap. And when I say Chinese junk, I don't mean a boat. Besides, these laws did not entirely disregard the interests of the colonies. Great Britain gave them a monopoly of tobacco raising, prohibiting Ireland from raising it. Poor Irish, they were on the ropes way back then. Would have been nice if they could have raised tobacco. England always gave Ireland short shift. Bounties or sums of money were often paid by the British government to colonial producers to encourage industry. These bounties were paid on indigo, tar, pitch, hemp, and many other industries which Great Britain was attempting to establish in the colonies in order to keep the empire from finding it necessary to buy them from foreign nations. These navigation laws aroused New England rather than the South, where it was the commercial section of the country. Another cause of the friction between the colonies and the mother country was the British land policy proclaimed in 1763. This policy ordered the colonial governors to grant no more land to settlers beyond a certain western border extending south from New England states along the western part of New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. C. Hockett, quote, his book was Political and Social History of the United States, Volume 1, page 115. This line extended down just east of the mountains and was to leave to the Indians the territory west of it. So here was England ruling against white people, white Europeans, and four Mongols. This western land was then to be purchased from the Mongols for the king. After that, the Mongols would go farther west, and their original territory was to be opened to settlers as soon as it was purchased. This arrangement was made by Great Britain to avoid conflict with the Mongols and the frontier settlers. The frontier settlers, however, objected, preferring to drive the Mongols back by more ruthless methods, even if it caused trouble. The western land speculators also did not like it because they could not sell their land until Great Britain had first pushed the Mongols back. The royal government immediately began making treaties with the Mongols for the purchase of their territory. The policy was wise and humane, but the settlers were too impatient to abide by it. That's right, they wanted to move west. Get out of our way. Don't apologize for it either. The Washington family was prominent in these western land speculations. Can you imagine if the Mongols had controlled the East Coast and it had been white people on the other side of the mountains? You think the Mongols would have, according to their Asiatic history, would have held back from going over the mountains and slaying all the white people? Give me a break. All this pacifist, peaceful Indian bullshit is just so much bullshit. A land lobby was kept in London by the speculators in their efforts to get large grants of western land from the crown and then sell it off as the country became more and more settled. In other words, it's a good deal, man. We'll get the king to give us this land real cheap and then we'll charge these settlers through the eyeballs, man. The next principal cause of trouble was the British financial legislation regarding the colonies. The colonies had issued fiat money or colonial bills of credit, which were in a form of paper money. Well, at one time they even had wooden money, wooden coins. Well, they couldn't be coins if they're wooden, but they looked like coins. These could not be redeemed and immediately began to depreciate in value, yet they were made legal tender by the colonial legislature so that they had to be accepted at payment of debt. Well, that's one reason, was because they were in severe depression and they had to do something. Often the colonies would buy goods from English and pay them with this colonial money. The southern planters were especially active in using it to pay their debts to their British creditors. The merchants of London soon complained of this practice. Finally, in 1764, Great Britain prohibited the colonies from issuing these bills of credit or fiat money, as such a procedure was considered unfair to their creditors. This, of course, aroused great opposition from those profiting by these currency, by this currency when paying their debts, yet no one now would defend such a financial policy on the part of the colonies. The popular conception today is that the Stamp Act of 1765 was the principal, if not the sole cause, of the American Revolution. This fact is greatly exaggerated, but it is the easiest to understand, and for that reason has been given the chief place among the many causes of the conflict. The Stamp Act was an act passed by Great Britain requiring the placing on all legal documents of stamps to be sold to the colonies by Britain. The usual impression is that this revenue was to go to the mother country and was to be a continual tax upon the colonies for the sole benefit of the crown. This impression is entirely false, however. The revenue from these stamps was to be used to pay one-third of the expense of a colonial army of about 10,000 men to be kept here for defense of the colonies, probably from the Mongols, because I don't think the French were prepared. I think they'd been pretty well driven out of Canada. So who else would have been coming in unless it might have been the Spanish? Not one penny was to go to Great Britain. Examine any elementary text on U.S. states' history. They speak of taxing the colonies, but leave the impression that the money was to go to Great Britain, whereas actually it was all to be spent for the protection of the colonies against possible trouble with the Mongols and the French. This colonial army had been proposed before the colonies. In the 1739, colonial leaders, under the leadership of the governor of Pennsylvania, had themselves proposed such an army supported by such a tax. But at the time, they felt the danger of the French in Canada. After the defeat of the French in 1763, this danger was no longer so threatening. When the Stamp Act was passed in 1765, its operation was delayed for 1 year in order to give the colonies an opportunity to agree among themselves about some other method of raising the money if they objected to the Stamp Act. The act was repealed in 1766 because of the bitter opposition of the colonies, who disliked a tax of any sort. Quote, "No taxation without representation has been greatly overemphasized. It is only half true, for it implies that taxation with representation would have been accepted." Well, if it didn't tax them, they couldn't have their 10,000-man army to protect them, which seems a little unfair of the leaders of the colonies. When the colonies objected to the Stamp Act, calling it an internal tax, Great Britain repealed it, and in 1767 passed the Townshend Act, which provided for a tariff on imports to the colonies. The imported goods, however, were boycotted, and Great Britain was forced to repeal the tariff on imports in 1770. The amount of imported goods in the New England colonies alone dropped from 1,363,000 pounds in 1768 to 504,000 pounds in 1769. After the repeal in 1770, the imports in 1771 were doubled. Thus, the boycott was a powerful weapon in the hands of the colonies. With it, the colonies were in a position to enforce almost any demand they liked upon Great Britain. Sounds to me like a lot of this bullshit was a little unfair on the part of the colonies. When the Townshend duties were repealed in 1770, a tax was still left on tea in order to assert the right to levy such a tax. In 1773, Great Britain allowed a tea company known as the East India Company to bring over a large quantity of tea. Of course, this is the company that controlled things in India through their mercantilism and did all the heavy work and then took the army with them if they had a problem. This company had been given a monopoly on colonial tea market. When this tea arrived in Boston on December 16, 1773, a group of men entered the ship and threw overboard the cargo valued at about 15,000 pounds. But why was this tea destroyed? Simply because the leaders of this act were tea merchants in Boston whose trade would have to compete with the newly arrived tea had it been permitted to enter the market. So this was simply a minor war between merchants. The act was the destruction of private property on the part of the participants. The more moderate element in Boston wanted the tea paid for and the action repudiated. As a punishment for this performance, Great Britain passed the five punitive and coercive acts of 1774. Britain should have laid back on this and let the cooler heads in Boston pay for this destruction of that tea. These five acts were the following: close the port of Boston until the tea should be paid for. You see here, every step along the way, if people would just back off a little bit and make a deal, they could get out of this revolution. Revise the Charter of Massachusetts. Send to England for trial colonial agents accused of violence in execution of their duties. Station soldiers in Massachusetts to aid in the execution of law. See, so England comes back, of course, being the mother country with more firm acts. And, of course, then the other side starts stampeding for more acts against the mother country. See, there's the war hawks all the time. There's war hawks, usually financially backed, that get us into these things. Annexed to Quebec, the land between the Ohio River and the Great Lakes, these acts were all legal. Great Britain had as much right to demand that Boston pay for the tea destroyed as we have to demand that a foreign power compensate our subjects for property loss there through mob action of its subjects. Another cause of the revolution, often overlooked, was the general economic depression both in the Great Britain and the colonies following the close of the French and Indian War in 1763. You see, there's always plenty of credit available during wars. The Rothschilds and all the banker people, they loan out all kinds of money. But the minute the war is over, they pull in the credit, and then you have deflation and you have depression. That's how it works, which causes even more trouble. This was felt in all the industries. Depressions of this sort always create political unrest and a desire for change in government, even though the authorities in power are in no way responsible for the condition. This is especially true in American political history. Presidential elections have been determined by economic conditions having no direct bearing upon the issues involved. That's very true, many times. The tenth and last cause we shall give of the American Revolution was the religious cause. Oh, there you go. There was a movement on foot to locate an Episcopal bishop in the colonies. At that time, all the clergy of the Episcopal Church were ordained in England, as there was no bishop here. Big deal. Consequently, all the Episcopal ministers came from abroad, and they were often mediocre. You mean they weren't like Billy Graham? For the more efficient among them were kept in England. Should have kept them totally out of the colonies. Everybody, all the churches. In 1770, there were about 250 Episcopal clergy in the colonies, most of whom were in Virginia. The rumor of locating a bishop here aroused resentment in the other denominations. Oh boy, here we go. Who unanimously opposed the plan. But the most effective, none of the religious war for power and money. But the most effective religious cause of the revolution came from still another source. When Great Britain extended Quebec down between the Ohio River and the Great Lakes, the Catholic Church was made the established church of these regions as it was in Quebec. This greatly incensed all Protestants, and no pope, no king became one of the slogans of the revolution. So you see how religion directly involves itself in problems that can lead to war. John Adams considered this religious animosity as much as any other cause of the war for independence. In other words, this religious fighting, infighting, could be the total cause of the war, the biggest cause of the war. Both these attitudes on the part of the colonies were unwise. An Episcopal bishop was badly needed here to elevate the Episcopal clergy and remove the unworthy ministers. In other words, they're not bringing in enough money, I guess. The prejudice against Catholics was simply folly. The Catholic priests in the colonies unanimously supported the revolution. If we examine the acts of Great Britain, which brought on revolution, we find that they were all legal. They were all in harmony with the spirit of the age. There was simply a general breakdown of mercantilism. Patrick Henry especially talked about the rights as British subjects. Were no such rights of which the colonies were being deprived. Had they remained in England, they would not have enjoyed, they would have enjoyed no privileges of which they were deprived by coming to America. Talk of this sort made effective oratory, but was false when examined. No taxation without representation is not a legal matter, but a commonplace political philosophy. We have many other examples of taxation without representation. The great majority of people in England were then disenfranchised, yet still taxed. Women were taxed before they were given the ballot. Many people are now taxed, even in those states where they are deprived of the ballot. Phrases as this regarding taxation were merely effective generalities without any meaning. The mistake of Great Britain was not in the passage of any illegal or unusual laws for governing the colonies, but it was in trying to rule a group of people against their will. Such a policy invariably invites trouble. Well, are we finding that out in the Middle East? Have we been finding it out for a long, long time? Nosing into other countries and occupying them. It never works for long. Instead of 13 units, as we usually regard the 13 colonies, there were three units differing in economic and political ideals. The coastal plains extended from New Hampshire to Pennsylvania constituted one, which was dominated by commercial interests. The second was the Tidewater section from Maryland to Georgia, which was primarily agricultural and was dominated by the planters. The third unit or section was the frontier with extreme ideas about political democracy. The first unit was commercial and interested in trade and shipbuilding. Great mercantile families had grown up there and accumulating their wealth largely through smuggling with the West Indies. To them, the navigation laws were especially offensive. Their chief desire was to restore the commercial conditions of before 1763, yet they bitterly opposed the withdrawal from the British Empire, for they wanted its protection. They dominated Boston, Newport, New York, and Philadelphia. They were Whig in opposing trade restrictions, but Tory in opposing separation. They had no sympathy with the political radicalism of Jefferson, Henry, and such leaders. The second region was the Tidewater region of the South. It was dominated by the planters, many of whom were heavily in debt to British creditors. They secured the passage of lax bankruptcy laws detrimental to non-resident creditors. These laws, however, were vetoed by the king, as were the laws provided for colonial bills of credit. These planters felt themselves aristocrats. Although they opposed British financial policy, they likewise objected to the democracy of Jefferson. The third section was the frontier. This section had often been discriminated against by the older sections in matters of representation in the colonial assemblies, administration of justice, and taxation. These inhabitants were jealous for popular rights and had no economic interest to the contrary. In domestic politics, they were out of harmony with the commercial and planter sections. The zeal of imagery, rights of man, gave great impetus to the movement for independence. Henry and Jefferson were the leaders of this section, and their point of view prevailed when the Declaration of Independence was written, the ideas of which were shocking to the other sections. These three sections reacted differently to the various British acts. In Georgia, the frontier people were pro-British because they were dependent upon Great Britain for subsidies and protection from the Mongols. The frontier people of North Carolina were also Tory because they had a sharp difference with the eastern part of the state. Had the frontier of all the colonies had a similar sharp difference with the coastal plains, they would no doubt have been Tory and defeated the Revolution. The frontier of Virginia got possession of the state and furnished such leaders as Henry and Jefferson. The Revolution was the American phase of an English Civil War. It was not so much a conflict between England and the colonies as between different classes of English people. It was a struggle between liberals and conservatives. What's new? The liberals were in control in the colonies while the conservatives were in control in Britain. In both countries, there was a large and influential minority group. The 13 colonies were a part of the British Empire and simply seceded, as the South did in 1860. You know, when you read this stuff, you got to read between the lines a lot, too, because there's been fratricide for centuries among white people. White people killing white people. All the great wars of Europe, all the religious wars and all of it. Fratricide. Killing each other by the millions. After Constantine and made Christianity the religion of the empire, things really got bad. And it's been bad ever since, to be perfectly honest about it. And can you imagine the economic interests and the agents and the provocateurs that were roaming in the colonies? Of course, Britain had their agents, of course, because they were still in power. Then you had the French. They were obviously interested in causing Britain trouble, thinking maybe they could get back their Canadian property. And you can probably see that it would be the interest of the French in the western areas of the settlers to cause unhappiness, even to the point of, like they did during the French and Indian Wars, employing Mongols to kill white people on both sides, Britain and France. And they could have been making deals with the Mongols west of the mountains to harass the people who were settling there, white people, to make it seem more like the British government couldn't protect them. And then, of course, in the southeast, you had this Spanish sitting there like a hungry dog looking to get their share. So it must have been a really, really weird time of it with all these factions. And but I still think the greatest faction was the banks and British East India Company, mercantilism, that are always trying to get it over on somebody else to make more money. And at the base of everything, including religion, that's what brings people into war. So anyhow, if you see a war coming, you can be sure there are economic interests behind it. I don't give a goddamn what country it is. Most of the time, these mercantile interests or capitalists, they don't want peace, unless they know they're going to get wiped out in the process. Pretty amazing how the German industrialists went along with Hitler didn't seem to realize that if things went wrong, they were going to be flattened like a pancake. Anyhow, back to the book. The terms Whig and Tory are often misleading or vague when applied to this period. Many Whigs in Great Britain, such as Burke, Fox, and Pitt, were opposed to the British policy of regulating the colonies. That's a lot like the anti-war people in this country that don't want to see the United States occupying and becoming an empire and occupying countries all over the world and murdering people all over the world. But they were equally opposed by granting them independence. Many of the American moderates were Whig in opposing the British navigation policy, but wanted to pay for tea destroyed in Boston, which would have been a smart move. Only 15,000 pounds were involved. That's not a lot of money, considering what a Revolutionary War costs. Many advocated an imperial union to handle such questions in the future. The radicals were for complete home rule and got control of the First Continental Congress of 1774. Like I said before, now remember all the turmoil that was going on in France at the time. And these guys are making deals and, you know, a lot of these guys were going to France and hobnobbing. Ben Franklin was hobnobbing with the ladies in Paris. At one time they had their peapots they kept under their bed. They had a picture of Ben Franklin on the bottom of the pot. So there was a lot of funny stuff going on, including the possibility that Ben Franklin was a British agent from the get-go. And that's another book you'd have to read yourself. The radicals were for complete home rule and got control of the First Continental Congress in 1774. There was never a general uprising of the whole colonial population. Well, that's the way in any war. Most people just want to be left alone. They don't want to rise up in any goddamn war. John Adams estimated that it was hard enough to make a living and live just from the conditions and the primitive situation in the colonies, yet alone going to a war. John Adams estimated that about one-third of the population were opposed to separation. That's a lot of people. The greatest problem of the revolutionists was to keep the spirit of revolt alive. How do you do that? Well, you create atrocities and things like that, and oh my God stories, and if we lose, this is what they're going to do to us, and all that. The media of the day does that. About 25,000 Americans enlisted in the British Army. In other words, to fight against the revolt. That's a lot of Americans. When the radicals declared the colonies independent in 1776, many men of property were shocked. Henry Lawrence wept when he heard the Declaration of Independence read, but there was rejoicing among the radicals. Well, see, some of your people with money were smart enough to know that this was going to be a big problem. Others were more willing to gamble their future and their lives on something that really didn't need to happen. A horse jockey neighbor said to John Adams, "Oh, Mr. Adams, what great things you and your colleagues have done for us. There are no courts of justice now in the province, and I hope there never will be any." There were many facts regarding our conduct during the Revolution which are not pleasant to relate. For example, on June 1, 1775, Congress passed a resolution disclaiming any intention of invading Canada. The report of this decision was widely circulated in Canada. About 4 weeks later, Congress secretly made plans for the invasion of Canada that fall. The invasion took place in September 1775, but Canada drove the invaders back. See the book by Leakey, The American Revolution, page 2015. Is there any difference between our invasion of Canada and the German invasion of Belgium? You see, this was written after the First World War, but before the Second. Many people suspected of being Tories were terribly badly treated. Well, the Sons of Liberty were a terrorist group, to be perfectly honest about it. They were burning Tories' houses down with people inside and so forth. There was a lot of that shit went on. The New York legislature passed a resolution that Tories should be deemed guilty of treason and should suffer death. In other words, if you believed in staying with England and the crown, kill you. That's okay. They were often hunted by mobs, tarred and feathered, and killed. American troops set fire to the houses of people to plunder and rob. In fact, in some sections, the colonists looked upon the British army with as much favor as the American army. New York alone confiscated $3,600,000 worth of property belonging to the Tories, who were loyal to the king. And all the states did likewise, which was, you know, that was out-and-out robbery. During the entire period, the Tories were the great sufferers. It is obvious that a person had as much legal and moral right to be a Tory as to be a Whig. That'd be like it's just as, you had just as much right to be a Republican as a Democrat, unless people wanted to use force to stop you. Provided he committed no act of violence against society, and the great majority of Tories had committed none. It was simply a question of difference in opinion. To punish a person for a difference of opinion cannot, of course, be harmonized with democracy. Majority rule does not mean coercion of minorities. Well, when has that not happened? Dictatorship of the majority can be the worst kind of despotism, that's for sure. Through the media, that's what we've got now, because the media whips people into a frenzy over one horror story, and the majority of the people go right along with whatever they want. When the Great Britain recognized the independence of the colonies in 1783, one provision of the treaty agreed to by both parties was that the Tories should be compensated by the states for the property confiscated during the conflict. The states, however, did nothing about it, but treated that provision as a scrap of paper. Now you know why so many people moved to Canada at that time, to get the hell out of here. And might have been wise, to be perfectly honest, just like in the Vietnam War, getting the hell out of here. Was our separation with Great Britain a wise or an unwise step? It is impossible to answer a question of this sort with certainty. Well, from what I've studied in history, and I've studied a lot, I think it was a mistake. That's my opinion. We assume that it was wise and beneficial, but to determine that, it would be necessary to roll history back, to let us remain a part of Great Britain, and then compare the two conditions. It has been argued that if we had remained a part of the British Empire, the democratic spirit of the colonies would have been a great help to the democratic element in Great Britain, that these elements cooperating would have democratized and federated all the English-speaking peoples, in which in turn would have aided democratizing the world. Such an idea can be upheld with assurance, but neither can one say dogmatically that the American Revolution resulted in our separation was for the best. We use the terms freedom and independence in too loose a sense when we say that we then gained our freedom of independence. Would the South have been free and independent if it had been the winning faction in the Civil War? Secession, or the changing of national boundaries, does not give freedom. Canada is free, although a part of the British Commonwealth. Texas is free, although it's a part of the United States, or it used to be free. So, that's the end of that section. The next, of course, is the War of 1812. But I just thought I'd take the liberty of reading that, and you can go on in your mind about what might have taken place if we had not have separated from England. And we truly could have had an effect on the, how people lived in England based upon representation in the colonies. And also this invasion of Canada was a very bad move, which has created a certain amount of distrust ever since between Canada and the United States. And I don't blame them. Okay. Well, that's about it for today. Comment on what I've read to you, if you feel like it. If not, well, I don't know what to tell you. But I think it's very interesting, and I think that every time the white race goes to war, we lose. In the long run, we always lose. So when you get so excited and pissed off at the left-wing people who don't want to go to war and don't want occupation and all that stuff, why do you disagree with them? Because they're right. They're right, and you should. That's why a lot of these factions need to come together. We don't need to come together on everything. No one ever does. But an alliance between people who realize that the alternative is so horrible, that this empire is so becomes such a monster, that you have everything to gain by negotiation with other people of other factions. 14:5.
Here's another one of these civic customs. Swearing on the Bible. You understand that, Shin? They tell you to raise your right hand, place your left hand on the Bible. Does this stuff really matter? Which hand? Does God really give a fuck about details like this? Suppose you put your right hand on the Bible, you raise your left hand. Would that count? Or would God say, sorry, wrong hand, try again? And why does one hand have to be raised? What is the magic in this gesture? This seems like some sort of a primitive voodoo mojo shtick. Why not put your left hand on the Bible, let your right hand hang down by your side? It's more natural. Or put it in your pocket. Remember what your mother used to say? Don't put your hands in your pockets. Does she know something we don't know? Is this hand shit really important? Well, let's get back to the Bible, America's favorite national theatrical prop. Suppose the Bible they hand you to swear on is upside down. Or backward, or both, and you swear to tell the truth on an upside-down, backward Bible. Would that count? Suppose the Bible they hand you is an old Bible and half the pages are missing. Suppose all they have is a Chinese Bible in an American court, or a Braille Bible, and you're not blind. Suppose they hand you an upside-down, backward Chinese Braille Bible with half the pages missing. At what point does all of this stuff just break down and become just a lot of stupid shit that somebody made up? They fucking made it up, folks. It's make-believe. It's make-believe. Now, all right. Okay. Let's leave the Bible aside. We'll get back to the science fiction reading later. The more important question is, what is the big deal about swearing to God in the first place? Why does swearing to God mean you're going to tell the truth? Wouldn't affect me. If they said to me, you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you, God, I'd say, yeah. I'll tell you about as much truth as the people who wrote that fucking Bible. How do you like that? Swearing on the Bible doesn't mean anything. It's kid. Swearing to God is kid stuff. Did you remember when you were a kid? If you told another kid something he didn't quite believe, he'd say, "You swear to God?" I would always say, "Yeah, I swear to God," even if I was lying. Why not? What's going to happen if I lie? Nothing. Nothing happens if you lie, unless you get caught, and that's a whole different story. Sometimes a kid would think he was being slick with me, and he'd say, "You swear on your mother's grave?" I'd say, yeah. Why not? First of all, my mother was alive. She didn't even have a grave. Second of all, even if she was dead, what's she going to do? Rise from the grave and come and haunt me? Come and haunt me? All because I told a lie to an 8-year-old? Get fucking real, will you? Sometimes I would say, I swear on my mother's tits. Kids are impressed with things like that. I mean, I don't care about my mother's tits either. I don't care if they fell off. Fuck her. Not my problem. They're your tits, Ma. You keep an eye on them. Swearing to God doesn't mean anything. Swearing on the Bible doesn't mean anything. You know why? Because Bible or no Bible, God or no God, if it suits their purposes, people are going to lie in court. The police do it all the time. All the time. Yes, they do. It's part of their job to protect, to serve, and to commit perjury whenever it supports the state's case. Swearing on the Bible is just one more way of controlling people and keeping them in line. And it's one of these superstitious things that holds us back as a species. Here's one more item for you.
And don't forget, you have no rights guaranteed to you by any spook in the sky. You have privileges given to you by the powerful and the wealthy people who control the show. And as long as you obey them and don't get too far out of line, you're okay. But if you get out of line and don't follow their dictates, the boot comes through the door and your privileges are gone, baby. Terrible Tommy, off and clear.